while inside the store. The entire time I fill my tank with gas, I wonder about Charlie. When I'm back on the road, I'm still wondering about Charlie. I wonder if Charlie's eaten anything. I wonder if she's alone. I wonder if she's being taken care of. I wonder how I'm possibly supposed to find her when she could be anywhere in the entire world right now. All I'm doing is driving in circles, slowing every time I pass a girl walking on a sidewalk. I don't know where to look. I don't know where to go. I don't know how to be the guy who saves her. I wonder what people do when they have no place to go and no place to be. I wonder if this is what it's like to be crazy, certifiably insane. I feel as though I have absolutely zero control over my own mind. And if I'm not the one in control, who is? My phone rings again. I look at the caller ID and see that it's Landon. I don't know why I pick it up to answer it. Maybe I'm just tired of being inside my own head and not getting any answers. I pull over to the side of the road to talk to him. Hello? Please tell me what the hell is going on. Can anyone hear you? No, he says. The game just ended. Dad is talking to the police. Everyone's worried about you, Silas. I don't respond. I feel bad that they're worried, but even worse, that no one seems to be worried about Charlie. Have they found Charlie yet? I can hear people shouting in the background. It sounds like he called me the second the game ended. They're looking, he says. But there's something else in his voice, something unspoken. What is it, Landon? He sighs again. Silas, they're looking for you too, they think. His voice is heavy with worry. They think you know where she is. I close my eyes. I knew this would happen. I wipe my palms down my jeans. I don't know where she is. Several seconds pass before Landon speaks again. Jeanette went to the police. She said she thought you were acting strange, so when she found Charlie's things in a backpack inside your gym locker, she turned them in to the police. You had her wallet, Silas, and her phone. Finding Charlie's things in my possession is hardly proof that I'm responsible for her disappearance. It's proof that I'm her boyfriend. Come home, he says. Tell them you have nothing to hide. Answer their questions. If you cooperate, they'll have no reason to accuse you. If only answering their questions was that easy. Do you think I have something to do with her disappearance? Do you? He asks immediately. No. Then no, he says. I don't think you have anything to do with it. Where are you? I don't know. I hear a muffled noise, like he's covering the phone with his hand. I can hear voices in the background. Did you get a hold of him? A man asks. Still trying, Dad, Landon says. More muttering. You there, Silas? He asks. Yeah, I have a question, I say. Have you ever heard of a place called Jamais Jamais? Silence. I wait for him to respond, but he doesn't. Landon, have you heard of it? Another heavy sigh. It's Charlie's old house, Silas. What the hell is wrong with you? You're on drugs, aren't you? Jesus Christ, Silas, what the hell did you take? Is that what happened to Charlie? Is that why? I hang up the phone while he's still in the middle of spouting off questions. I search Brett Winwood's home address on the internet. It takes me a while, but two addresses pop up in the results. One I remember because I was just there earlier today. It's where Charlie lives now. The other is one I don't recognize. It's the address to Jamais Jamais. The house sits on 6 acres, overlooking Lake Bourne. It was built in 1860, exactly 1 year before the Civil War began. The house was originally named La Terre Rencontre l'Eau, which means land meets water. It was used as a hospital during the war, housing wounded Confederate soldiers. Years after the war, the house was purchased by a banker, Frank Winwood, in 1880. The home remained in the family, passed down 3 generations until landing in the hands of then 30-year-old Brett Winwood in 1998. Brett Winwood and his family occupied the home until 2005, when Hurricane Katrina caused extensive damage to the property. The family was forced to abandon the home, and it sat untouched for several years before renovations began. The entire house was gutted and rebuilt, with only portions of the original outer walls and roof salvaged. In 2011, the Winwood family moved back into their home. During the unveiling, Brett Winwood announced the home had been given a new name, Jamais Jamais. When asked why he chose the French translation of Never Never, he says his daughter, 14-year-old Charlize Winwood, actually decided on the name. She says it's an homage to family history. Never forget those who paved the way before you. Never stop trying to better the world for those who will inhabit it after you. The Winwood family occupied the home until 2013 when it went into foreclosure following an investigation into Winwood Nash Financial Group. The home was sold in auction in late 2013 to an anonymous bidder. I add the page to my favorites in my phone and make a note of the article. I found it after I pulled up to the property, right up to the locked gate. The height of the gate is impressive, as if it's letting visitors know that the people beyond this gate are mightier than the people who are not. I wonder if that's how Charlie's father felt living here. I wonder how mighty he felt when someone else took ownership of the property that's been in his family for generations. The property is located at the end of an isolated road, as if the road belongs to the gate, too. After attempting to find a way around or through the gate, I conclude that there isn't one. It's dark now, so I could be missing a path or an alternate entrance. I'm not even sure why I want past the gate, but I can't help but feel like the pictures of this property are clues. Considering I'm wanted for questioning, it's probably best if I don't drive around any more than I have to tonight. So I decide to stay here until morning. I turn off my car. If I'm going to be worth anything tomorrow, I need to try and get at least a few hours of sleep. I lean my seat back, close my eyes, and wonder if I'm going to dream tonight. I don't even know what I would dream about. I can't dream if I don't sleep, and I have a feeling falling asleep tonight is going to be impossible. My eyes flick back open with that thought. The video. In one of my letters, I mentioned falling asleep to a video of Charlie sleeping. I search my phone until I find it. I press play and wait to hear Charlie's voice for the first time.
14. Charlie. More sleeping. Not because of the pills this time. I pretended to swallow them and kept them in my cheek. She stayed so long they were starting to dissolve. As soon as the door closed behind her, I spit them into my hand. No more drowsiness. I need to be clear of mind. I slept of my own accord and had more dreams earlier. Dreams of the same guy as in the first dream. Or should I say the first memory? In my dream, the guy was leading me through a dirty street. He wasn't looking at me. He was looking ahead, his whole body pulling forward like some invisible force had hold of him. In his left hand was a camera. He stopped suddenly and looked across the street. I followed his gaze. "There," he said. "Look." But I didn't want to look. I turned my back on what he was seeing, looked at a wall instead. Then all of a sudden, his hand was no longer in mine. I turned and watched him cross the street and approach a woman sitting cross-legged against a wall. In her arms, she cradled a tiny baby wrapped in a woolen blanket. The guy crouched down in front of her. They spoke for a long time. He handed her something, and she smiled. When he stood up, the baby started to cry. That's when he snapped the picture. I could still see her face when I woke up. But it wasn't a real-life image. It was a photo. The one he took. A ragged mother with knotted hair, staring down at her infant, his tiny mouth open in a scream. Their backdrop, the chipped paint of a bright blue door. When the dream was over, I wasn't sad like last time. I wanted to meet the boy who documented suffering in such vivid color. I lie awake most of what I assume is the night. She returns with breakfast. "You again," I say. "Never a day off, or an hour." "Yep," she says. "We're understaffed, so I'm working doubles. Eat." "Not hungry." She offers me the cup of pills. I don't take them. "I want to see a doctor," I say. The doctor is very busy today. I can make an appointment for you. He can probably see you sometime next week. No, I want to see a doctor today. I want to know what medication you're giving me, and I want to know why I'm here. It's the first time I've seen anything but bored friendliness on her face. She leans forward, and I can smell the coffee on her breath. Don't be a brat, she hisses. You don't get to make demands here. Do you understand me? She shoves the pills at me. I'm not taking those until a doctor tells me why I am, I say, nodding toward the cup. Do you understand me? I think she's going to hit me. My hand feels for the piece of pipe under my pillow. The muscles in my shoulders and back tense, the balls of my feet press down on the tile. I am ready to spring if I need to. But the nurse turns, inserts her key into the door, and is gone. I hear the click of the lock, and then I'm alone again.
15. Silas. I can't believe you got away with that, I say to her. I drop my hands to her waist, pushing her until her back is against her bedroom door. She places her palms against my chest and looks up at me with an innocent grin. Got away with what? I laugh and press my lips against her neck. It's an homage to family history, I laugh, moving my lips up her neck, drawing closer to her mouth. What are you going to do if you ever want to break up with me? You'll be stuck living in a house that was named after the phrase you use with your ex-boyfriend. She shakes her head and pushes against me so she can walk past me. If I ever want to break up with you, I'll just have Daddy change the name of our house. He would never do that, Char. He thought the BS meaning you gave him was genius. She shrugs. Then I'll burn it to the ground. She sits on the edge of her mattress, and I take a seat next to her, pushing her onto her back. She giggles as I lean over her and cage her in with my hands. She's so beautiful. I've always known she was beautiful, but this year has been really good to her. Really good. I look down at her chest. I can't help it. They've just gotten so perfect this year. Do you think your boobs are finished growing? I ask her. She laughs and slaps me on the shoulder. You're disgusting. I bring my fingers up to where her t-shirt scoops down at her neck. I trail my fingers across her chest until I meet the dip in her shirt. When do you think you'll let me see them? Jamais, jamais, she says with a laugh. I groan. Come on, Charlie baby. I've loved you for 14 years now. That should earn me something, a quick peek, a hand up the shirt. We're 14, Silas. Ask me again when we're 15. I smile. That's only 2 months away for me. I press my lips to hers and can feel her chest rise against mine with her quick intake of breath. God, the torture. Her tongue slips inside my mouth as her hand cradles the back of my head, pulling me closer. The sweet, sweet torture. I lower my hand to her waist, inching her shirt up little by little until my fingers have access to her skin. I splay my hand out across her waist, feeling the heat from her body against my palm. I continue to kiss her as my hand explores more of her inch by inch, until one of my fingertips meets the fabric of her bra. I want to keep going, to feel the softness beneath my fingertips. I want to... Silas! Charlie sinks into the mattress. Her entire body is absorbed by the sheets, and I'm left palming her empty pillow. What the hell? Where did she go? People don't just disappear into thin air. Silas, open the door. I squeeze my eyes shut. Charlie, where are you? Wake up. I open my eyes and I'm no longer in Charlie's bed. I'm no longer a 14-year-old boy about to touch a boob for the first time. I'm Silas, lost and confused and sleeping in a damn car. A fist pounds against my driver's side window. I allow my eyes a few more seconds to adjust to the sunlight pouring into my car before I look up. Landon is standing at my door. I immediately sit up and turn around, looking behind me, to the sides of me. It's only Landon. No one else is with him. I reach for the handle on the door and wait for him to step aside before I swing it open. "Did you find her?" I ask, stepping out of my car. He shakes his head. "No, they're still looking." He squeezes the back of his neck just like I do when I'm nervous or stressed. I open my mouth to ask him how he knew where to find me. But then I close my mouth after remembering I asked him about this house right before I hung up on him. Of course he would look here. "You need to help them find her, Silas. You have to tell them everything you know." I laugh, everything I know. I lean against my car and fold my arms across my chest. I stop smiling at the ridiculousness of the situation, and I lock eyes with my little brother. "I don't know anything, Landon. I don't even know you. And as far as my memory is concerned, I've never even met Charlize Winwood. How am I supposed to tell the police that?" Landon's head is tilted. He's staring at me, silent and curious. He thinks I've gone crazy. I can see it in his eyes. He might be right. "Get in the car," I tell him. "I have a lot to tell you. Let's go for a drive." I open my door and climb back inside. He waits several seconds, but then he walks to the car parked in the ditch. He locks it and then makes his way to my passenger door. "Let me get this straight," he says, leaning forward in the booth. "You and Charlie have both been losing your memories for over a week now. You've both been writing yourselves letters. Those letters were in the backpack Jeanette found and turned into the police. The only person who knows about this is some random tarot reader. It happens at the same time of day, every 48 hours, and you claim to have no recollection of what happened the day before she went missing?" I nod. Landon laughs and falls back against his seat. He shakes his head and picks up his drink, sticking the straw in his mouth. He takes a long sip and then sighs heavily as he returns his glass to the table. "If this is your way of trying to get away with her murder, you're going to need a much stronger alibi than a damn voodoo curse. She's not dead." He raises a questioning eyebrow. I can't blame him. If the tables were turned, there's no way in hell I would believe everything that just came out of my mouth. "Landon, I don't expect you to believe me. I really don't. It's ridiculous. But for the sake of shits and giggles, will you just humor me for a few hours? Just pretend you believe me and answer questions for me, even if you think I already know the answers. Then tomorrow you can turn me into the police if you still think I'm crazy." He shakes his head and looks disappointed. "Even if I thought you were crazy, I would never turn you into the police, Silas. You're my brother." He motions for the waiter to come over and refill his drink. He takes a sip and then gets comfortable. "Okay, fire away." I smile. I knew I liked him for a reason. "What happened between Brett and our father?" Landon laughs under his breath. "This is ridiculous," he mutters. "You know more about that than I do." But then he leans forward and begins to answer my question. "An investigation was launched a couple of years ago due to an external audit. A lot of people lost a lot of money. Dad was cleared and Brett was charged with fraud." "Is Dad really innocent?" Landon shrugs. "I'd like to think he is. His name was dragged through the mud and he lost the majority of his business after what happened. He's been trying to rebuild it, but no one trusts him with their money now, but I guess we can't complain. We still fared better than Charlie's family did." "Dad accused Charlie of taking some files from his office. What was he talking about?" "They couldn't figure out where the money went, so they assumed Brett or Dad was hiding it in offshore accounts. There was a stretch before the trial where Dad didn't sleep for 3 days. He went through every detail of every transaction and every receipt recorded for the past 10 years. One night he came out of his office holding a file. He said he found it, found where Brett was keeping the money. He finally had the information he needed to hold Brett responsible for the entire thing. He called his lawyer and told him he would deliver the evidence as soon as he got a couple hours of sleep. The next day, he couldn't find the files. He blew up on you, assuming you had warned Charlie about it. He believes to this day that Charlie took those files. She denied it. You denied it. And without the evidence he claimed to have, they could never charge Brett on all counts. He'll probably be out of jail in 5 years with good behavior, but from what Dad says, those files would have put him away for life." Jesus, this is a lot to remember. I hold up a finger. I'll be right back. I slip out of the booth and run out of the restaurant, straight to my car. I search for more paper to take notes on. Landon is still at the booth when I return. I don't ask another question until I write everything down he just told me. And then I feed him a tidbit of information just to see how he responds. I'm the one who took those files, I say to Landon. I look up at him, and his eyes are narrowed. I thought you said you can't remember anything. I shake my head. I can't, but I made a note about some files I found that I was hiding. Why do you think I would take them if they would have proved Dad's innocence? Landon ponders my question for a moment, then shakes his head. I don't know. Whoever took them never did anything with them. So the only reason you would have hid them is to protect Charlie's father. Why would I want to protect Brett Winwood? Maybe you weren't protecting him for his own sake. Maybe you were doing it for Charlie. I drop the pen. That's it. The only reason I would have taken those files is if I were doing it to protect Charlie. Was she close to her father? Landon laughs. Very. She was a daddy's girl through and through. In all honesty, I think the only person she loved more than you was her father. This feels like I'm unraveling a piece of a puzzle, even if it's not the puzzle I should be unraveling. Knowing the old Silas, he would have done anything to make Charlie happy, which includes protecting her from knowing the truth about her father. What happened with me and Charlie after that? I mean, if she loved her father that much, you would think my father putting him behind bars would have made her never want to speak to me again. Landon shakes his head. You were all she had, he says. You stuck by her side through it all, and nothing pissed Dad off more than knowing you didn't stand by his side 100%. Did I think Dad was innocent? Yeah, Landon says. You just made it a point not to take sides when it came to him and Charlie. Unfortunately, to Dad, that meant you were taking their side. The two of you haven't been on the best terms for the past year or two. The only time he speaks to you is when he's yelling at you from the stands at Friday night games. Why is he so obsessed with me playing football? Landon laughs again. He's been obsessed with his sons attending his alma mater since before he knew he was having sons. He's shoved football down our throats since we could walk. I don't mind it, but you always hated it. And that makes him resent you even more because you have a talent for it. It's in your blood. But you've never wanted anything more than to just be able to walk away from it. He smiles. God, you should have seen him when he showed up last night and you weren't out on that field. He actually tried to have the game stopped until we could find you, but the officials wouldn't allow it. I make a note of this. You know, I can't remember how to play football. A smirk plays on Landon's lips. Now, that's the first thing you said today that I actually believe. The other day when we were in a huddle, you seemed lost. You, do that thing, he laughs out loud. So add that to your list. You forgot how to play football. How convenient. I add it to the list. Remember song lyrics. Forgot people we know. Remember people we don't know. Remember how to use a camera. Hate football, but I'm forced to play. Forgot how to play football. I stare at the list. I'm sure I had a lot more stuff written down on my old list, but I can hardly remember any of it. Let me see that, Landon says. He scrolls over the notes I've already taken. Shit, you're really taking this seriously. He stares at it for a few seconds and then hands it back to me. It seems like you can remember things you wanted to learn yourself, like song lyrics and your camera, but anything else you were taught, you forgot. I pull the list in front of me and look at it. He might have a point. Other than the fact that I can't remember people. I make a note of that and then continue with my questions. How long has Charlie been seeing Brian? Were we broken up? He runs his hand through his hair and takes a sip of his soda. He pulls his feet up and leans against the wall, stretching his legs out on the seat. We're gonna be here all day, aren't we? If that's what it takes. Brian's always had a thing for Charlie and everyone knows it. You and Brian have never gotten along because of it, but you make it work for the sake of the football team. Charlie started to change after her father went to prison. She wasn't as nice, not that she's ever been the nicest. But lately, she's actually turned into somewhat of a bully. The two of you do nothing but fight now. I honestly think she hasn't been seeing him for that long. It started with her just giving him attention when you were around so she could piss you off. I guess for her to continue that, she had to keep up appearances with him when they were alone. I don't buy it that she likes him, though. She's a hell of a lot smarter than he is, and if anyone was being used, it was Brian. I'm writing everything down, but I'm also nodding my head. I had a feeling she wasn't really into the guy. It seems like my relationship with Charlie was stretched as thin as air, and she was just doing what she could to test our strength. What are Charlie's religious beliefs? Was she known to be into voodoo or spells or anything like that? Not that I know of, he says. We were all raised Catholic. We don't really practice unless it's a significant holiday. I make note of that and try to think of another question. I still have so many, and I don't know what to go with next. Is there anything else? Anything out of the ordinary that happened last week? I can immediately tell he's hiding something by the change in his facial expression and the way he shifts in his seat. What is it? He pulls his feet off the seat and leans forward, lowering his voice. The police. They were at the house today. I heard them questioning Ezra about finding anything unusual. At first, she denied it, but I think her guilt got the best of her. She mentioned finding sheets in your room. She said there was blood on them. I lean back against my booth and stare up at the ceiling. This isn't good. Wait, I say, leaning forward again. That was last week, before Charlie went missing. It can't be tied to her if that's what they're thinking. No, I know that. Ezra told him that too, that it was last week and she saw Charlie that day. But still, Silas, what the hell were you doing? Why was there blood on your sheets? The way police think, they're probably assuming you beat Charlie or something and that it finally went too far. I'd never hurt her, I say defensively. I love that girl. As soon as the words leave my mouth, I shake my head, not understanding why I even said them. I've never even met her. I've never even spoken to her. But I'll be damned, I just said I love her, and I meant it, straight to my core. How can you love her? You claim you can't remember her. I may not remember her, but I sure as hell still feel her. I stand up. And that's why we need to find her, starting with her father. Landon tries to calm me down, but he has no idea how frustrating it is to lose 8 entire hours when you only have 48 hours total. It's after 8 o'clock at night already, and we've already wasted the entire day. As soon as we left the restaurant, we headed toward the prison to pay Brett Winwood a visit, a prison that's almost 3 hours away. Couple that with a 2-hour wait, only to be told we aren't on the visitor list and there's nothing we can do today to change it. I'm more than pissed. I can't afford to make mistakes when I have just hours left to figure out where she is before I lose everything I've learned since yesterday. We pull up next to Landon's car. I kill my ignition and step out of the car, walking to the gate. There are 2 padlocks on it, and it looks like they're never used. Who bought this house? I ask Landon. I hear him laugh behind me, so I turn around. He sees that I lack humor in this situation, so he rolls his head. Come on, Silas, drop the act already. You know who bought the house. I breathe steadily in through my nose and out my mouth, reminding myself that I can't blame him for thinking I'm making all of this up. I nod and then turn to face the gate again. Humor me, Landon. I can hear him kick at the gravel and groan. And then he says, Janice Delacroix. The name means nothing to me, but I walk back to my truck and open the door to make a note of the name. Delacroix. Is that a French name? Yeah, he says. She owns one of those tourist shops downtown, reads tarots or some shit like that. No one knows how she was able to afford the place. Her daughter goes to our school. I stop writing. The tarot reader. That explains the picture and also why she wouldn't give me more information on the house, because it seemed weird to her that I was asking about her home. So people actually live here, I say, turning around to face him. He shrugs. Yeah. It's just the 2 of them, though, her and her daughter. They probably use a different entrance. Doesn't look like this gate gets opened much. I stare past the gate at the house. What's her daughter's name? Cora, he says. Cora Delacroix. But everyone calls her the shrimp.
16. Charlie. No one comes for a long time. I think I'm being punished. I'm thirsty, and I need to go to the bathroom. After holding it as long as I can, I finally pee in the plastic cup on my breakfast tray and set the full cup in the corner of the room. I pace back and forth, pulling at my hair until I think I'm going to go crazy. What if no one comes back? What if they've left me here to die? The door won't budge. I bruise my fists, pounding on it. I scream for someone to help me until my voice grows hoarse. I'm sitting on the floor with my head in my hands when the door finally opens. I jump up. It's not the nurse. It's someone else this time. Younger. Her scrubs hang off her small body. She looks like a little kid playing dress up. I eye her warily as she moves across my small room. She notices the cup in the corner and raises her eyebrows.
Do you need to use the facilities?
She asks.
Yes.
She sets the tray down, and my stomach grumbles. I asked to see the doctor, I say. Her eyes dart left to right. She's nervous. Why?
The doctor is busy today, she says, not looking at me.
Where is the other nurse?
It's her day off, she says.
I can smell the food. I am so hungry. I need to use the bathroom, I say. Can you take me? She nods her head, but she looks afraid of me. I follow her out of the little room and into the small hallway. What kind of hospital has the toilets in a separate area from their patients' rooms? She stands off to the side while I use the restroom, wringing her hands and turning an awful shade of pink. When I'm finished, she makes the mistake of turning toward the door. When she opens it, I pull the piece of pipe from my hospital gown and hold it toward her neck. She faces me again, and her beady eyes grow wide with fear.
Drop the keys and back up slowly, I say, or I'll stick this straight in your throat.
She nods. The keys clank against the ground, and I advance toward her, my weapon extended toward her neck. I push her backward, into the same room, and shove her down on the bed. She falls back and cries out. Then I'm out the door, taking the keys with me. I pull the door shut as she flies toward it, her mouth open in a scream. We struggle for a moment, her trying to yank it open while I get the key into the lock and hear the metal click. My hands are shaking as I sort through the keys, trying to find the right one to open the next door. I don't really know what to expect when I step through. A hospital hallway, nurses and doctors. Will someone be there to drag me back to that tiny room?
No.
There's no way I'm going back. I'll hurt anyone who tries to stop me from getting out of here. I don't see a hospital or staff or anyone else when I open the door. What I see instead is a very impressive wine cellar. Dusty bottles sit in hundreds of little holes. It smells of ferment and dirt. A staircase runs up one side of the cellar. There is a door at the top. I run for the stairs, stubbing my toe hard on the concrete and feeling the wet blood run over my foot. I almost slip on it, but I catch onto the railing in time. The top of the stairs opens to a kitchen, a single light illuminating the counters and floors. I don't pause to look around. I need to find a door. I grab the handle, and this time it's not locked. I cry out in triumph as it flies open. The night air hits me in the face. I breathe it in gratefully. Then I run.
17. Silas. You can't trespass, Silas, Landon yells. I'm trying to scale the gate, but my foot keeps slipping. Help me over, I yell down to him. He walks up to me and offers his hands, palms up, despite the fact that he's still verbally trying to stop me from climbing over. I step into his hands and he hoists me higher, allowing me to grab the bars toward the top of the gate. I'll be back in 10 minutes. I just want to check out the property. I know he doesn't believe a word I've said today, so I leave out the fact that I think this Cora girl knows something. If she's inside that house, I'm going to force her to talk to me. I finally make it to the top and down the other side. When my feet hit the dirt, I stand up. Don't leave until I get back. I turn and take a look at the house. It's about 200 yards away, hidden behind rows of weeping willow trees. They look like long arms, swaying toward the front door, coercing me to move forward. I slowly make my way down the path that leads to the porch. It's a beautiful house. I can see why Charlie missed it so much. I look up at the windows. Two of them are lit up on the top floor, but the bottom floor is completely dark. I'm almost to the porch that extends across the entire front of the house. My heart is racing in my chest so fast that I can actually hear it. Other than the occasional insect noise and the pounding of my pulse, it's completely quiet out here. Until it's not. The bark is so loud and so close it rumbles in my stomach and vibrates through my chest. I can't see where it's coming from. I freeze in my tracks, careful not to make any sudden movements. A deep growl rolls through the air like thunder. I slowly look over my shoulder without turning my body. The dog is standing behind me, lips pulled back in a snarl, teeth so white and sharp they look like they're glowing. He rears back on his hind legs, and before I can run or look around for something to fight him off, he's in the air, lunging toward me, straight for my throat. I can feel his teeth pierce the skin on the back of my hand, and I know if I hadn't covered my throat, those teeth would be in my jugular right now. The massive strength of this animal knocks me to the ground. I can feel the flesh give way on my hand as he thrashes his head from side to side, and I try to fight him off. But then something slams into it or on top of it, a whimper, and then a thud, and then silence. It's too dark to see what just happened. I take a deep breath and try to stand. I look down at the dog and a sharp piece of metal is protruding from his neck. Blood is pooling around his head, tinting the grass the color of midnight. And then a strong scent of flowers, lilies, surrounds me in a rush of wind. It's you. I recognize her voice immediately, even though it comes out in a whisper. She's standing to the right of me, her face illuminated by the moonlight. Tears are streaking their way down her cheeks, and her hand is cupped over her mouth. She's wide-eyed, staring at me in shock. She's here. She's alive. I want to take her in my arms and hug her and tell her it's okay, that we're going to figure this out, but she more than likely has no idea who I am. Charlie? She slowly lowers her hand away from her mouth. My name is Charlie? She asks. I nod. The terrified expression on her face slowly transforms into relief. She steps forward and throws her arms around my neck, pressing her face against my chest. Sobs begin to rack her body now. We need to leave, she says through her tears. We have to get out of here before they find me. Find her. I wrap my arms around her long enough to hug her, and then I take her hand and we run toward the gate. When Landon sees Charlie, he rushes to the gate and begins to shake the locks. He tries to find a way to get us out so she doesn't have to climb over, but he can't. Use my car, I tell him. Bend the gate. We have to hurry. He looks back at my car and then again at me. You want me to break open the gate? Silas, that car is your baby. I don't give a shit about the car. I yell, we need out. He acts fast, running straight to the car. As he climbs inside, he yells, get out of the way. He puts the car in reverse and backs up, then slams on the gas. The sound of iron on metal isn't nearly as loud as the sound my heart makes seeing the car being torn to shreds. At least I wasn't that attached to it. I've only known it less than 2 days. He has to back up and drive forward 2 more times to bend the iron enough for Charlie and me to slip through. Once we're on the other side of the gate, I open the back door to Landon's car and help her inside. Just leave my car here, I tell him. We can worry about it later. When we're all in the car and finally heading away from the house, Landon picks up his cell phone. I'll call Dad and tell him you found her so he can notify the police. I grab the cell phone from his hands. No, no police. He slams his hand against the steering wheel in frustration. Silas, you have to tell them she's okay. This is ridiculous. You're both being completely ridiculous with this. I turn in my seat and stare at him pointedly. Landon, you have to believe me. Charlie and I are going to forget everything we know in a little over 12 hours from now. I have to get her to a hotel so I can explain everything to her, and then I need time to make notes. If we notify the police, they might split us up for questioning. I need to be with her when this happens again. I don't care if you don't believe me, but you're my brother, and I need you to do this for me. He doesn't respond to my request. We're at the end of the road now, and I can see the roll of his throat as he swallows, trying to decide whether to turn left or right. Please, I ask him. I just need until tomorrow. He releases a pent-up breath and then turns right, the opposite direction from our homes. I breathe a sigh of relief. I owe you one. More like a million, he mutters. I look in the back seat at Charlie and she's staring at me, obviously terrified by what she's hearing. What do you mean this'll happen again tomorrow? She asks, her voice trembling. I crawl into the back seat with her and pull her to me. She melts against my chest and I can feel her heart racing against mine. I'll explain everything at the hotel. She nods and then, did he call you Silas? Is that your name? Her voice is raspy, like she's screamed herself hoarse. I don't even want to think about what she's been through since yesterday. Yeah, I tell her, rubbing my hand up and down her arm. Silas Nash. Silas, she says softly. I've been wondering what your name was since yesterday. I immediately stiffen and look down at her. What do you mean you've been wondering? How do you remember me? I dreamt about you. She dreamt about me. I pull my short list of notes from my pocket and ask Landon for a pen. He pulls one out of his console and hands it to me. I make a note about the dreams and how Charlie knew me without having memory of me. I also note that my own dream about her felt more like a memory. Could our dreams be clues to our past? Charlie watches me as I write down everything that has transpired in the last hour. She never questions me, though. I fold the paper up and slide it back into my pocket. So, what's the deal with us? She asks. Are we, like, in love and shit? I laugh out loud for the first time since yesterday morning. Yeah, I say, still laughing. Apparently, I've been in love and shit with you for 18 years now. I told Landon to come to our hotel room at 11:30 tomorrow morning. If this happens again, we'll need time to adjust and read the notes to get acclimated to our situation. He was hesitant, but he finally agreed. He said he would tell Dad he's been out looking for us all day with no luck. I feel bad for making people worry until tomorrow, but I'm not about to put myself in a situation where I let her out of my sight again. Hell, I wouldn't even let her shut the door when she said she wanted to take a shower. A warm shower, she clarified. When we got to the hotel, I told her everything I knew, which, once I laid it all out, didn't seem like much. She told me what had happened to her since yesterday morning. I'm relieved it was nothing too serious, but disturbed that they were holding her in the basement. Why would the shrimp and her mother be keeping Charlie against her will? The woman was obviously trying to mislead me yesterday when she said, "The answers to your questions lie with someone who is very close to you." Yeah, I'd say. The person with answers was very close to me, a mere 2 feet away. I feel like this information is one of the best leads we've gotten in the past week, but I have no idea why they were holding her captive. That's the first thing I want us to figure out tomorrow, which is why I'm ensuring our notes are detailed and precise so we can get an even better head start. I've already made a note for Charlie to go to the police station and ask for all her belongings to be returned to her. They can't keep them now that she's no longer missing, and we desperately need those letters and journals. The key to everything could be written in there somewhere, and until it's all back in our possession, we're completely stuck. The bathroom door opens wider, and I hear her walking toward the bed. I'm sitting at the desk, still writing notes. I glance up at her as she sits on the mattress, her feet dangling off the edge of the bed as she watches me. I expected, after her ordeal, that she'd be more shaken up, but she's tough. She listened intently when I explained everything I knew, and she never once doubted me. She even threw out a few theories herself. Knowing me, I'll probably try to run tomorrow if I wake up in a hotel room with a guy I've never met, she says. I should probably write myself a note and stick it over the door handle, telling myself to wait until at least noon before I hightail it out of here. See? Tough and smart. I hand her a piece of paper and a pen, and she writes herself a note and then walks it to the hotel room door. We should try to get some sleep, I tell her. If this does happen again, we need to be well rested. She nods in agreement and climbs onto the bed. I didn't even bother asking for two beds. I don't know why. Not that I have any ideas about how the night's going to play out. I think I'm just extremely protective of her. The thought of not knowing she's right next to me makes me too uncomfortable, even if it would have been a different bed just 2 feet away. I set the alarm for 10:30 in the morning. That'll give us time to wake up and prepare, while hopefully giving us a good 6 hours of sleep. I turn out the lights and crawl into bed beside her. She's on her side and I'm on mine, and I'm doing everything I can to not scoot over and spoon her, or at least put my arm around her. I don't want to freak her out, though. But it also somehow feels natural for me to do those things. I fluff my pillow and turn it over so the colder side is against my cheek. I face the wall and keep my back to her to make sure she doesn't feel uncomfortable having to share a bed with me. Silas? She whispers. I like her voice. It's comforting yet electric. Yeah? I can feel her roll over to face me, but my back is still to her. I don't know why, but I feel like we'll both sleep better if you have your arms around me. Not touching you seems more awkward than touching you. Even though it's dark in the room, I try to fight my smile. I immediately roll over and she scoots back against my chest. I wrap my arm around her and pull her closer, her body curving perfectly into mine, her feet locking around my feet. This must have been why I felt an unwavering need to find her. Because until this very second, I didn't know Charlie wasn't the only one missing. When she disappeared, part of me must have disappeared right along with her. Because this is the first time I felt like me, like Silas Nash, since the second I woke up yesterday. She finds my hand in the dark and slides her fingers through mine. Are you scared, Silas? I sigh, hating that she's falling asleep thinking about it. I'm worried, I tell her. I don't want it to happen again, but I'm not scared, because this time, I know where you are. If it were possible to hear a smile, hers would be a love song. Good night, Silas, she says quietly. Her shoulders rise and fall when she lets out a deep sigh. Her breathing begins to taper off after only a few minutes, and I know she's asleep. Before I close my eyes, she readjusts her position slightly and I catch a glimpse of her tattoo. The silhouette of trees is peeking out of the top of the back of her shirt. I wish there was a letter that would have described the night we got those tattoos. I would give anything to have that memory back, to see what it was like between us when we loved each other enough to believe it was forever. Maybe I'll dream about that night if I fall asleep thinking about it. I close my eyes, knowing this is exactly how it's supposed to be, Charlie and Silas, together. I don't know why we ever started drifting apart, but I'm certain of one thing. I'll never allow it to happen again. I press a soft kiss into her hair, something I've probably done a million times, but the drunken, one-winged moths fluttering around in my stomach make it feel like the very first time. Good night, Charlie baby.
18. Charlie. I wake up to sunlight. It's streaming through the window and warming my face. I roll over to look for Silas, but his pillow is empty. For a moment, I'm afraid that he's left me, or that someone has taken him. But then I hear the clink of a cup and the sound of him moving. I squeeze my eyes shut gratefully. I can smell food. I roll over.
Breakfast, he says. I crawl out of bed feeling self-conscious about the way I must look. I comb my fingers through my hair and wipe the sleep from my eyes. Silas is sitting at the desk, sipping on coffee and writing something down on paper. I pull up a chair and seat myself across from him and grab a croissant, tucking my hair behind my ears. I don't want to eat, but I do anyway. He wants us to be well rested and fed before the clock strikes 11 a.m. But my stomach is full of nerves, thinking about how it felt waking up with no memory 2 days ago. I don't want that to happen again. I didn't like it then, and I won't like it this time. Every few seconds, he glances up at me, and our eyes lock before he goes back to work. He looks nervous, too. After the croissant, I eat the bacon, then the eggs, then a bagel. I finish off Silas's coffee, drink my orange juice, and pull my chair back from the table. He smiles and taps the side of his mouth. I reach up and dust the crumbs off my face, feeling warmth rise to my cheeks. He's not laughing at me, though. I know that. He hands me a toothbrush still in its package and follows me to the bathroom. We brush our teeth together, eyeing each other in the mirror. His hair is standing on end, and mine is tangled. It's sort of comical. I can't believe I'm in the same room as the boy from my dreams. It feels surreal. I look at the clock as we leave the bathroom. We have 10 minutes to go. Silas has his notes ready, as do I. We lay them out on the bed so it's all circling us. Everything we know is here. This time is going to be different. We're together. We have Landon. We're going to figure this thing out. We sit facing each other on the bed, our knees touching. From where I sit, I can see the red letters of the alarm clock hit 10:59. 1 minute. My heart is racing. I'm so afraid. I begin the countdown in my head. 59, 58, 57, 56. I count down to 30, and Silas suddenly leans forward. His hands cup my face. I can smell him, feel his breath on my lips. I lose the time. I have no idea what second I'm supposed to be on. Never, never, he whispers. His warmth, his lips, his hands. He presses his mouth to mine and kisses me deeply. And I... to be continued.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Never Never Part 2, written by Colleen Hoover and Taryn Fisher, performed by Kevin Free and Elizabeth Evans. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2015, Colleen Hoover and Taryn Fisher. Production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.